You'll have to excuse both of us because we're both sick, and so he maybe sounds better than me, and we'll talk more, and we both have like cold medicine in us, so it should make it better, right? So we'll talk, and then we'll show some images, and if you have questions or things to say to us, you should just talk and shout out at us, and we'll respond, probably. So go ahead.
Let's see if we can end up tangled in the cords and fall over by the end. Okay, so first we're going to talk about the gaze a little bit, which is the boring part, and then we're going to talk about the drones, which is the exciting and sexy part. So the gaze is a way, it's something that's been talked about a lot in feminist literature, cinema theory as well, other places about the power implicit in visual images. The gaze is a form of power. It is directed from one point towards a second point. You can think about the camera lens. That's one way of looking at it, although it doesn't always include a camera lens. But there's somebody directing the camera, and there's somebody who's being looked at, and that's kind of the gaze dynamic. We want to problematize that a little bit and talk about the gaze more as like the technological fact of vision. It's not the decision that a person makes or the cultural context in which that vision is going on, but it's the electromagnetic radiation perceived by a sensor. It's the perception of color, of light intensity, of wavelength. It's no different in mechanics than tuning a radio through a frequency band. It's about shape, architecture, and space, not so much about power dynamics. The power dynamics come into play when technology plugs into society, but the gaze can be something on its own that's technologically sort of more simple in that way. So the primary critique of the gaze comes from psychoanalysis, and that's Lisa Rigueret, this quote here that's up there, that's what she's talking about. So there's a sense in psychoanalysis that to see something, the vision was better than any other sense, and it was the way that something was determined to be there, and this is talking about the castration complex. So, in Freud, the castration complex happens when the young boy sees the young girl and sees that she doesn't have a penis, and all of a sudden he's afraid that his penis can be taken away, because to not have a penis is obviously missing something, at least in that sort of logic of Viennese psychoanalysis. But Rigueret critiques this and says that nothing to be seen is equivalent to having no thing, no being, and no truth, and we all know that's not true, because there's all sorts of truth that's invisible, that's hard to grasp, and there's definitely sex organs that exist on the little girl, but Freud was not willing to create his theory along those lines.
So essentially, are there any, does anyone want to comment or ask questions or chime in about that at all? Yeah, that's good. So that's sort of what we're bringing up here in order to problematize some images that we're going to be showing you, and we're going to be talking about different technological modes and mechanisms and apparatus of creating image, and then we're going to essentially be getting to the end and talking about sexuality both within these images and essentially the sexuality of the apparatus or devices that are creating these images. So I'm going to let you talk a little bit more because I'm already losing my voice.
Okay. So I'll just continue then. So this power of vision also extends to power in society. So if you think about surveillance with democracy, the whole mantra is, if you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to hide. If you didn't do us anything wrong, you should show everything. If you've done something wrong, you should still show everything and be exposed, because that's the justice of democratic society, is that this light will bring out truth, will bring the bad people to their comeuppance, and will vindicate the good people in the end. So we have this sort of visual metaphor for society that also focuses on this positive presence, this power of the gaze. And I think General Alexander, the head of the NSA, might really believe that, from some of his public statements, that he really believes that more information will only further democracy, by having all of this information controlled by a single power source. So we know that surveillance is not just about seeing a person in particular. It's about holding all the informational cards. Once you have that power, you can use that power for anything you want, not just democracy and upholding what's right and good or fighting terrorists or something like that, but also checking out the what your spouse is doing at home, which the NSA apparently also does. That's something that is very much true. So you're caught in these other logics. The gaze is always caught in these logics, not just the logic of democracy and of right and wrong, but the logic of capitalism, as in this quote by Foucault. There's always contradicting authorities here. So we're going to get on to the exciting part right now. That's the boring part. So technology, a drone or anything else, is not nearly as simple as it may seem. It's not just a tool that General Alexander uses to collect information. It has its own dynamics, it has its own authorities, and its own feelings invested in it. So a drone can do a very simple task. It can do a direct task, like go to spy on somebody in a foreign country that a other plane could not necessarily fly over. But a drone, through the way that a drone works as a flying platform that can have a camera mounted on it, it introduces other variables into the equation. So we're going to look at some various technologically specific gazes. We're going to look at drones. We're going to look at GoPro cameras. We're going to look at dashboard cams, so-called Russian dashboard cams, which we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about the Nine Eyes, which is the Google Street View car. And we're going to talk about some smartphone apps. And then CCTV.
So I think basically what we're going to be trying to do is we're going to show you some images and we're going to show you some videos also. And within the context of each of these different modes of creating images, so whether it be apps or whether it be drones, we're going to try and show a spectrum of, I mean, we're not going to be arguing that either image is good or bad, but something that falls along and says, you know, that sort of rhetoric about how all drones are bad, you know, any image created by a drone is bad. We're going to show that there are images created by drones which are, you know, lovable and cuddly and that people get very excited about. And then we're going to take something like a GoPro camera, which many people, you know, it's pretty innocuous. You film yourself mountain boarding down a mountain, and we're going to show some problematic images that are created by that apparatus, and we'll kind of go through and show these videos as well, and ultimately to discuss the fact that what we're encouraging people to do is think about the social processes behind these images and ultimately look at the apparatus more themselves, as opposed to just looking at the image and how it's posted and criticizing that, which I think is a problem that both of us have seen in, you know, the academic fields that we work in, and, you know, where you write online, that often people are just discussing the images and how they're presented, and we want to encourage a more dynamic view of these images and videos. So.
Okay, so this is what a drone is capable of here. So we're looking at the evolution of a drone's camera from the what they call the soda straw view, which is the zoomed in, can only see one particular point in space. That's kind of the first evolution here that's the left from your point of view, to the Gorgon Stare, which was an upgrade technology that allowed multiple camera sensors to be mounted on a single drone. Let's see, you could get how many there? That's just 30 images all at once. To the Argus, which is an upgraded camera pod that actually uses the same same light sensors that are in most smartphone cameras. It's no more powerful than that, but it creates this dome of 300 of those sensors around a ball, and this creates a continuous panorama image that then can be zoomed in by the software, and it can pull out 65 different clips of this single composite image from this one sensor on this one aircraft. So the technology here really makes a difference. This is the difference between sort of standing on your balcony with a telescope and kind of looking over the city to putting CCTV cameras all over the city. You have like an extreme upgrade in the amount of surveillance that you can do and the sort of tracking that you can follow. Your awareness and your gaze is extended to a huge degree. So let's go ahead and play the first video clip.
This actually has, we're probably going to stop this before the actual, you know, this shows the actual strike, and I think if that's all right with all of you, we'll just kind of show.
Yeah, we're not going to show the actual strike, we're just going to show the,
And then if you want to watch the...
These are all from YouTube, so you can find drone strike porn to your heart's content if... It's funny, but also not funny. So this is a view from a drone that is over Pakistan. This was a strike on a group of suspected insurgents, and you can let it go. It's up to a minute. It's fine. So you can see they can barely see some figures here, and this is the old SodaStraw type. They haven't released any videos from the upgraded Golden Sierra or Argus technology, but this is how they observe people from the air. So this is one sort of drone gaze. This sort of and the thing to remember is that on the other end of those crosshairs is a laser designating system that air to surface missile can be released to hit whatever that crosshairs is pointing at. So that's the other thing to remember, that that's the thing implicit in this gaze. Let's go ahead to the other video. Some of the other drone videos. It would be on like several monitors, or actually there was a Nova program. You know, the PBS series Nova had they have the only, I believe, access to show this, and they had it on one of these like large wall touch surfaces where you saw the entire composite image, and then you could actually drag the image out and like, you know, kind of Minority Report style interface of like, you know, seize that image, play that back, and it's kind of crazy. So look up that Nova show about drones.
How about retail surveillance? Walmart, you name it.
Yeah, we're gonna get to CCTV, so we're gonna hold off on that and show a little bit more of drone view before we get to that. So here is a. This is a drone video that was shot at a protest in Poland that this kind of made the round, so you might have seen it. It'll get going in just a second. So you can see here's a different sort of drone gaze. This is this was kind of hailed by protesters. Occupy Wall Street went out and bought a drone after this video made the rounds, after it went viral, because this was viewed as like a new sort of image, a new way of visualizing protest that you couldn't capture from the ground. And there's many people working on this. There's the Drone Journalism Lab, which is out of the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. Excuse me. And we're working on these sort of pro-public kind of applications for the drone, ways that you can use an airborne camera platform in a way that's not just for targeting somebody, targeting insurgents, but possibly, you know, police monitoring, news coverage, these sorts of more, we might go ahead and say ethically, a little bit more socially positive applications. Yeah, go ahead. So this was from the recent protests in Istanbul in Turkey. This was another drone video. This one, I believe, is fairly short, so maybe we watch the whole thing because it ends with the drone being shot down by the police, which is actually not very exciting in the video because once the drone is shot down, you can't see anything anymore. So it's a cut off of the gaze that, you know, maybe they crashed into something. You really don't get this sort of action movie climax that you might hope for, yeah, with like a drone being shot down.
Showed the scene over Taksim Square, which is at the center of the protest.
Excuse me.
Shows a huge.
But you can see this is a different sort of gaze. This is a view of a protest.
Tear gas floating.
Of a riot situation. Of a police riot situation where you wouldn't ordinarily get this sort of view. So this is what the technology has enabled. This sort of case.
Some really unique footage giving an overview of exactly what was going on in and around the square. He also got some amazing views over this. Just to find out more about why people have been protesting against Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey and what was happening in the initial couple of days of protest, there's a couple of videos over on the left-hand side of the screen now.
It doesn't even show it. Anticlimactic. Yes. It depends on the sort of drone. Actually, let's do the mount. Is the mountain biking one in there?
Drone is shot down. Whatever it's already seen is gone.
It's already recorded. Well, it really depends on the technology. So there's a lot of, and this is something about drones that are so interesting, is that this one term drone sort of encompasses in the social mind everything from a $300 toy that you can fly around the room inside with your iPhone, to a multi-million-dollar vehicle that is deployed that can fly for 72 hours without refueling, some of them. Yes. I believe it was just a handgun. It's difficult to tell, but given that it was just a cop out on the street, I would imagine that that's what it was. Yeah. I mean, this idea of drones is like this new radical way of of viewing a protest is a little bit overblown when you consider how delicate these things are. They can just fall out of the air because of, you know, they lose radio connection, their batteries only last, some of these sort of smaller models, their batteries only last for 5 or 6 minutes. So if you run out of power, then you lose your stable flight, and then that's the end. Okay, so this
will be some of the more benign.
Yeah, so this mountain bike video, this is something that a lot of people are using drones for, is to make really cinematic sorts of sports videos. There's skiers and other extreme sports that use drones to get new camera angles that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get. And yeah, motorcycle stunts, all those sorts of X Games sort of things. So you can see these crazy airborne tracking shots would not be possible. You can make this with, you know, $400, $600 drone and your MacBook, and then, you know, your motocross star, just like that. So this is something that the drone gaze has also enabled. This is a different way of looking at it. Yeah, that's they cut it and they put in the cool rock soundtrack and uploaded it with their logo. Okay, so one more drone video. So here's a drone at Burning Man. I think this is from this past year. There are so many drones at Burning Man this year that they actually put out UAV guidelines, and they had a discussion group get together to sort of like craft these guidelines. They were having problems with people flying them near the pyrotechnics displays, and the radio frequencies can interact badly with the pyrotechnics. So. But again, here, the point is that you're seeing a new image, a new way of looking at the world that's enabled by this particular technology. We're seeing everything in the range from Burning Man to extreme sports to protest coverage to surveillance and targeted killings. Okay. Yeah, the reason we put these images is to show, so this is kind of another unique thing about drones, is that the image of drones themselves have sort of taken on a life of their own. At protests against targeted killings and anti-war protests, you see these drone effigies. There's actually a company that makes drone effigies for sale to protests. It's about as much as the sort of cheapest drone. I think it's like $300 to get yourself a plastic predator that you can hold up on a broomstick and cart through your city streets. So, I mean, this is so interesting. It's like, why when you're protesting something do you want to have an image of it there? What does that mean? Is it that the drone looks mysterious and scary, and this is kind of to symbolize that drones could be over American cities next, or what does this mean exactly? And I don't know. We really haven't unwrapped that fully, but we wanted to kind of just like mention that as like a thing to think about when we're thinking about not only drones as being a means for image capture, but they're also an image in themselves. This is by Matthew Smith. We didn't put the name in there. This was done for the Mineration Festival, which is an art festival that I co-curated online about art of the drones. And it was brilliant, and people loved it, and this thing kind of went viral, and I got boinked, and you know what that means, all you internet people. So there's kind of, there's multiple feelings going on here. You know, obviously this is like a satire, it's ironic, it's supposed to be making fun of the kind of the deployment of drones as if it was like an innocuous thing, but it also kind of makes them more friendly at the same time. I think I'm not alone in wanting to see this series be produced. I would like to see a bunch of drones interact and go on lovely adventures together.
Yeah. What else do we have?
Do you want to talk about GoPro? I guess that's where we're at now.
Yeah, I don't know if I support the creation of that. I don't know if I want my name associated with the creation of my little drone. You stand alone with that. So I think that thinking with the I'm sorry, but showing our drone video of Burning Man, as people love that video, you know, a lot of burners are like, that's so exciting, we get to see the whole city, it's got great comments, you know, aside from the drones being around the temple burn in general, people are pretty excited about drones, they like that bird's eye view and, you know, such not. And so I think that's where, you know, when we're thinking about this talk, it's a good way to make a transition into some of the other ways that images are captured at Burning Man and some of the problematic ways in which people's, and this is kind of a huge debate. There are some people that say, probably this is San Francisco, many of you have been to Burning Man, or at least are, yeah? No? In any event, so at least thinking about it in that way, you know, we transitioned to the use of GoPro cameras at the event, and they, you know, you see, especially this last year, many people with these GoPro cameras strapped to themselves in a variety of ways, and they're sort of going. Oh yeah, they're pretty. Do most people know what a GoPro camera looks like? It's a smaller.
Smaller than a cell phone.
Yeah, it's square.
It comes with a lot of accessories for attaching.
Yeah.
Helmets or cars.
Surfboards, like all. It's meant to be, you know, it itself is pretty small, but then you can use a variety of different ways to attach it to your person or whatever device you're riding or interacting with. So, so this is, you know, the GoPro cameras on the end of the surfboard, the GoPro cameras on the mountain bike helmet, etc. And so at Burning Man, you're seeing people attach it to themselves in ways that are, you know, visible. You watch somebody walking by and you're like, oh, they have this like apparatus strapped to themselves. And then it's also embedded into certain devices in order to capture images of people in ways that are not always consensual in the sense that people are not being notified of the fact that this device that they're interacting with contains a GoPro camera with it. So one of the, we saw it with the Hula Hoops and then also with Seesaws with these GoPro cameras kind of stuck in the, where the sea, like the sea of the seesaw would be and then facing outwards. And so the, sure, fulcrum, it's a fancy, that's a good word for it. So no, that's good. The fulcrum. So that, you know, that's sort of where you often see this advertised and you're thinking this is a pretty innocuous thing. And then you see these problematic videos and images of, you know, this, the video that this comes from specifically has about 20 very attractive young women using this hula hoop with the GoPro, and this video is put together and put on YouTube, and it kind of becomes in your mind, you're like, are these the only people who used the hula hoop? Were these women? I don't know, you know, or were they solicited to use the hula hoop by somebody who let them know about it? Or, you know, it opens up a lot of questions as to how this image gets brought into being. And so, could you go ahead again?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So once again, to return, the problematic here is the technology is enabling the technology is enabling a sort of image capture that has a lot of ins and outs to it. It can be both good, you know, you can take a sweet video of yourself surfing, and that's all well and good. You know, the sort of things that you see in the GoPro ads, the people skydiving, skiing, these sorts of very innocuous things. Or this technology can be somewhat, you know, twisted and like enable new forms of image capture that were not available before and that are problematic from a number of standpoints. And you know the thing about we were going to talk about Russian dashboard cam sex.
You want me to pull that one up?
Yeah. The Meteor camera that sort of, or the Meteor that was caught on a number of Russian dashboard cams, sort of brought the phenomena into the public consciousness. But basically, the deal is that in Russia, traffic law is often a factor of who has the most money, not who's necessarily at fault. So if you have a camera that's constantly recording on your dashboard, you can see that somebody else, you know, came out and ran the red light and T-boned you, and it wasn't the other way around. So your image will then speak louder than somebody else's money when dealing with the authorities. But, you know, all sorts of places have dashboard cams. They're in taxis. They're in police cars, they're in trucks, they're all over the place, they're in school buses. But this sort of phenomenon of Russian dashboard cams has kind of become romanticized, maybe because of the sort of nature of the road in Russia, and so we have a short bunch of clips. Yeah. It doesn't really make you want to drive in Russia. I don't know. So you end up with these clip videos of people doing outrageous things and of outrageous things happening, and it sort of becomes this cultural phenomenon of these you know, candid camera kind of clip show mentalities. Some are funny, some are horrifying, some are terrible, some are amazing. But this is something that the technology has enabled. By having this technology fill this particular niche, it's created this genre of image, this Russian dashboard cam video genre. The Queen soundtrack is, that just makes it clear. Okay, you can go down a YouTube hole on your own time.
There's a lot of really good videos of people who will walk on the street and be like,
Yeah, but sort of like try and get the insurance money or, you know, some sort of cash settlement. So this need for technology, this sort of technology. So a dashboard cam is constantly recording. It's often not a very good frame rate, but it has enough memory to store like 24 hours. So you just leave it on constantly and it will loop. It will keep recording over the old footage until you have an accident and then you say stop and then you go back and pull out that footage. Or if your car gets broken into or whatever, you want to use the dashboard cam for. So it creates this genre of image by the technology, and we wanted to talk about that in terms of we wanted to use that as sort of a segue into the street view. The street view images. So if there's a great Tumblr called Nine Eyes that it's just nineeyes.tumblr.com if you want to look it up. And I'm not sure if they're submitted or if there's somebody who's just going out and like looking at a ton of street view images to pull all these out. But they pull out some amazing images that are captured by the street view cameras. Some like this. This is people throwing rocks at the street view car. Some people not liking Google. Here's one. I believe that one is from Mexico. There's a cop holding a suspect at gunpoint in the bed of a truck. So that's kind of an incredible image. Here's kind of a beautiful one. It's some sort of plastic being dragged out the back of another truck that was passing the street view car. Yeah, I kind of like that. I mean, a lot of these images, they're just kind of incredible. They're not necessarily like caught in the moment sort of images, but it's like you see this sort of deserted house on the end of a one-way street, and it's like, who would have taken a picture of that with the Google Street View car did? And it's out there. So this is another great one of some apparently non-pro Googlers expressing their views. There's a cow crawling across the road, which is just, you know, there's got to be some crazy story behind that. And then this is one that Megan actually found of a leaf hitting the street view camera as it fell off a tree. That's in the... Yeah, it's kind of pretty. It does this weird sort of, like, image thing when it's hitting the lens. So, you know, we know what these images are. We're kind of familiar with them. If you don't see the, you can see the compass rose sort of thing up in the top corner, and you know that it's a street view camera. If you've done enough Google mapping, you immediately recognize what that is, and you can see an incredible image like this, and it may just be like, was a photographer in the right place? But then you see the compass rose, and you're like, oh wow, this is trapped there. As part of the map of that part of the world, that image is stuck there until the next time the street view car passes. So the technology has sort of enabled this different sort of image to become stuck to our interpretation of the world. And that's a totally different sort of technological gaze. So where are we here?
Snapchat.
Oh, okay, so Snapchat. Snapchat is next. So you know, those the street view images, they're kind of, some of them are irreverent, some of them are amusing, some of them are beautiful, but it's kind of this sort of thing where there's people subverting the street view camera, there's people throwing rocks at it. Another popular sort of subgenre of that is people mooning the camera or exposing themselves to the camera. That's one that happens a lot. I didn't find any, or we didn't stick any in the slideshow. But
what does Google do? Like, people flash.
Oh, they blur it out. Can you see the masked person there on the right has this kind of the digital blurring sort of thing. And Google uses facial recognition algorithms in order to auto blur the faces of people, that ordinary pedestrians that are caught in the street view, drivers of other cars. They don't want to keep people's faces in there, so they blur them out.
So do they also have like genital recognition?
You know, I don't know. I would imagine that there's some sort of Oh yeah, there you go. There's a flagging system. So. Can you? I haven't tried. Well, they say about the NSA headquarters that nothing actually interesting happens there because the cars leave at night and on the weekends, and obviously the NSA doesn't shut down. So the secret facilities that you don't know about, that's where the cars are parked there 24 hours a day. So those are just the people who answer the phone.
I've seen street signs obscured on
Yeah, I think text is the thing they block out because they don't like businesses to be able to advertise through Street View. So, you know, if you had a business, you might be tempted to put out a big billboard that had your name and phone number on it or something like that. I don't know. I'm not really sure about the exact policies. So that would be something to look into, though, to sort of see what flies and what doesn't fly. Oh, really? Interesting. So with the street view though, what we're getting at with all this is that this is out in the street. The street is like a public space, and yet there's this camera traveling around recording all of this public space and compiling it in an accessible way. So people can try and abuse that public space, can abuse the technology, or they can take advantage of it. But so we have these social ideas of what is public space and of what an image means that's been uploaded into a quasi-public space. And so that's where Snapchat comes in. There's sort of this New York Times editorial-esque, like, moral outrage about the wild west of the internet where you can upload a naked picture of yourself at any time and send it to somebody because that's, you know, that really upsets people. That really upsets people, but there are social rules about that. You know, there's rules to Snapchat. So Snapchat, if you're unfamiliar, is an app where you send a photo to somebody and they have about 10 seconds to look at it, and then it disappears. So they click on it, they open the picture, they look at it, it's on their screen for 10 seconds and disappears. Now you can break that rule by taking a screenshot of your phone and saving that image, but then the app will notify the other person that they've taken a screenshot. So there's these social rules about what you're supposed to do and what you aren't supposed to do, and the app creates this sort of atmosphere of rules in order to make it more usable, so that within these limited set of rules, you can send a naked picture to somebody, but it'll disappear, so it's okay. So or maybe it's not okay anyway. You know, then you can get mad at your friend for sending you a naked picture when you didn't want one or something like that. With other image sharing, there's also a ton of rules. With Tumblr, with Instagram, with anything, all this image appropriation stuff where people will take somebody else's image and claim it as their own. There's a very developed social set of rules about how you're supposed to use this technology. So it doesn't just enable a free-for-all, it enables a very complex social environment. What else we got here? Oh, okay, so But then, so we talked about all these kind of fun ways of using technology to capture images and sharing images, but there's still an overbearing sense of power to all of this. And we want to talk about closed circuit television to sort of bring this out. The DLC is the Domain Awareness Center, and if there's anybody from Oakland, they might know about this because Oakland is going to be building one of these. And a Domain Awareness Center takes CCTV images from various government-owned cameras, privately-owned cameras, just all sorts of different ones. You can see this as kind of like a list, stuff from the port, from National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, weather cameras, traffic cameras, and feeds it all into one center where they can look at all these images all at one time and really collect this power and sort of make these random cameras, which, you know, a DOT camera might be used to prevent traffic tie-ups or to, like, look out for accidents, but now these images are being appropriated by law enforcement. So this is kind of the overbearing theme of all of this, is that even though this tech can be used in different ways and these GAYs enable all these sorts of more playful kind of ludic things that you can do with digital images, we still have this idea of power. We come back to the GAYs at the end here, that any of these images can be seized and be used in the wrong way by an authority if they choose to, if they're allowed to, if they can, depending on the technological capabilities. Here's another picture. New York City also already has their version of the Domain Awareness Center, and that this is an image from their screen. They've got a bunch of different cameras there from the Stock Exchange that are all fit into the same room. In Boston, they are going to be installing one, I believe, if I remember correctly, after the marathon bombs that went off in Boston. That was kind of the catalyst, because it took them so long to compile all the different surveillance camera footage from private sources. They had to go out on the street and collect it. So they're going to be looking at installing one of these domain awareness centers, so all of that, as much footage as possible, is already being collectively organized and collected in one place.
Only parts of it.
Doing what?
I said the DHS, I think it's
And so ultimately what we're asking everyone to do here, and we sort of started off on this from looking at drones and ended up, you know, going through these different examples, is we're taking something that, like the drones, which often just people say, you know, these drones are bad, drones are evil, drones are scary, and we're trying to at least give some sense that, you know, this apparatus can be more multifaceted than all of that, and then also take the fact that there are other you know, there are other images which can be thought of neutrally. You know, maybe Google Street View is something that, while there are people that have strong impressions about that, many people just look at it as a tool that can help them in certain circumstances, and they're not really viewing it beyond that. And we're asking people to think about these images and the processes behind it in a more complex way. And so we'd like to answer any questions anyone has.
We do have one more. We do have one more video we want to close with, the camera over video.
Okay.
Camover was a anarchist, I believe it was, you know, created by some anarchist organizations, a contest to see who could destroy the most surveillance cameras in the time leading up to a government conference in Europe. And so this is their... So this is their promotional video for the Camover contest, and
you have to film yourself smashing the cameras in order to get points, and so your goal is to smash as many cameras as you can, but you have to provide evidence of smashing.
Dafür plädiert, dass an großen Plätzen genau solche Videoüberwachung eingesetzt wird. Das sind aber Dinge, über die darf man nicht diskutieren, die muss man einfach machen.
Just like the mountain bike video, a good soundtrack will help any video go viral. Different sorts of technological power involved, in the original formulation of the gaze, it was very male female, that in sort of stemming from the critique on psychoanalysis, the sort of male behind the camera, the female in front of the camera. When technology gets complicated, there's still obviously a lot of those. That sort of objectification, that sort of standard cultural objectification goes on, but the technology becomes more complicated. So, kind of closing thought: what is the sexuality of the drones, of the technology? What's the identity that any particular technological form has and brings to bear on any sort of image relationship, image capture relationship? So, thank you.
Questions?
I guess I'll try. I observed my male gaze when I saw particular works. I think the title was The Bathers. It was more or less of nude women, but they were staring back at me, and that made me very uncomfortable. So my male gaze was disrupted, and it made me think about that. Is there a corresponding disturbing image that you can put on these screens? that will make that guy disturbed?
So that guy being the NYPD counter-terrorism. Yes.
There's the CCTV player.
There's a group called like the CCTV players who like go up to security cameras and they like put on performances for whoever happens to be at the end of that to kind of make them aware of that.
That's one thing.
I mean, also maybe an answer to that is, you know, they're most interesting to me is the fact that you can do that type of performance. There's a couple different groups that engage, you know, performing at the security camera or even just simple gestures where, you know, a teenager gives the finger to the mall. So I don't know, you know, there's everything from that up until something that's very complex. And then ultimately that, you know, that could be disruptive to whoever's on the other end, but it could also just be a meaningless gesture because so much of this is being you know, recorded and images are being generated, but you don't actually have the sense that you don't know that there's going to be somebody on the other side that's watching it. And so, you know, when you think of like transit cameras, Department of Transportation cameras that just, you know, watch different highways in a variety of different areas, you know, those sit unwatched the majority of the time, and so is the performance that you're creating in front of that useful, or is it only useful if somebody else is seeing it? So I think that ends up being, I think I'm thinking of that specific instance, but it's like, you know, are you thinking that performance is only being meaningful if it's actually disrupting another human viewer on the other side, or is the performance meaningful in and of itself?
I think that's why specifically like street theater and flash mobs took off the very moment the stuff could be recorded.
Mm.
Because more people were interested in doing something and then be able to showing it to a broader audience without just like doing something and nobody sees it, which also has like a really interesting special flair. But you have
I just wanted to add something that I did just think of is sort of the cop watch efforts that in various cities they have citizens go out and try and film police encounters with people to have like another gaze going on. Yeah, surveillance. Yes, is
Bamboozer is another app that does the same thing.
Bamboozer.
Yeah, Bamboozer is an app that directly loads the internet immediately, so the cop can smash the phone, but it's still safe. You can make it private or public.
So in a lot of protests, you sort of see, especially in the recent Occupy protests, the phenomenon with live stream, which was very new at that time, which was sort of a way that you could stream from your phone directly to the internet, so people could be watching live what was happening in front of your phone. And that sort of goes into the old protest chant, the whole world is watching, you know, try and have the idea that there are other eyes that are watching you, so you better behave yourself. And that both works and doesn't work. I could give another talk about how much I hate live stream, actually. I think
it was really like, especially Occupy, it was horrible. Like, there were people out there live streaming for hours and hours, and the one thing I learned is that some activists just don't have anything to say.
Right. Yeah, and some have too much to say as well. That's kind of the problem that I have with live stream, is that you kind of get these media personalities that develop with the idea that you're constantly on, and once you see, oh, I have 1,000 people watching me, that sort of affects a person's behavior in a way that's not always possible. So yeah, I mean that's a whole different can of worms, but
thank you. I really appreciated your positive approach and looking at the good uses of some of this technology, and you obviously pay attention and enjoy your research a lot. The especially the Russian cam seems to be a favorite. But on the negative side, which of these things that you're talking about really gets you the most worried about privacy? It makes your rectum clench the most.
My rectum clenched the most. Hmm. No, actually, the one that worries me the most is the domain awareness centers. It's not so much the capturing of data; it's what is then done with the data. Because as Megan was saying, you know, maybe there's somebody not watching the surveillance camera, but if all that is archived and then can be accessed by algorithms that search for faces and then feed this into other sorts of data crunching algorithms like Palantir, which was started by PayPal as a way to try and predict fraud and has now been used to predict crime by looking at what sort of people hang out in front of what sort of corners at what time of day, sort of these sorts of things that we are, you know, there's this rush to embrace big data as a way of being able to unlock all this information that we can't possibly scan through ourselves, whether it's, the Google blowing out or the flagging system that, sort of crowdsources that a little bit. It's really what happens to the data. That's what worries me the most.
You have anything here?
Well, I mean, I guess in that would, our secret here is that you're the anarchist blogger and I'm actually a tactical police dispatcher, so yeah. So it's kind of an odd thing, especially given my, well, I don't know how that happened, but here I am nonetheless. But I think the idea behind that is that, you know, you kind of know, we both know right now what happens to a lot of this data. You know, there's in Portland where I work, there's tons of cameras recording all kinds of stuff. I have no access to it. You know, if police are looking for a suspect in an area, I have no access to cameras, can't use them. The only thing that's any good is TriMet cameras, but it usually takes, that's the public transit, it usually takes about 24 hours to get that footage, and so that's only useful in the after effect, like when you're prosecuting somebody to be like, here's the video of this. So I think that, you know, when he mentions that it's these domain awareness centers which are the scariest, it's, I think that comes from the knowledge right now that a lot of this stuff that's going on with data collection really has no, you know, it doesn't go anywhere right now in terms of like what police or their agents are actually able to do with it. And so I guess I would agree with that. And then also, you know, it's something that then in my profession, we talk about it and we're like, oh, you know, we're looking for this person. It would be nice to have a drone in order to be able, like, that's something that people say. They're like, it would be nice to be able to have a drone to, you know, watch where this person is going. And so I think that's something that informs what we're talking about here, too, is the hopes that some, the fears that the public already thinks that we're able, we being like the state in that case, are able to see them in ways that we cannot. You know, very often I talk to people on 911 lines and they say something like, well, you can see what just happened, right? And I'm like, no, that's real. That happens a lot where people, they're like, well, you see what just happened to me. And I'm like, I don't know how I would have been able to do that. And so there's this idea that the public has about what we're able to do from, you know, I guess television or whatever else, which we can't do, and then these sort of desires that people have in order to enact some of those things. And so maybe the intersection of those two things is actually the most frightening, the fact that people already think that it's happening, they want it to happen, and that the police want it to happen too.
Yeah, and that there's actually the whole debate in the U.S. about the NSA stuff going on, that most people are not, at least they're not shocked about the whole thing because they expect that that happened anyhow. So,
And they really do, I mean, that's,
The thing I wonder about, we're over there overseas dropping bombs via drone. I wonder how long is it going to be before they're over here dropping bombs via drones. I mean, is the technology that complicated that an independent group or country can't figure out how to do it? And pretty soon we'll be looking up and wondering what that white thing is.
Well, I mean, that is something that, like, the Los Angeles, the LAPD is kind of in the process of obtaining a drone, so it's something that, I mean, you can speak a little bit more about that, but it is something.
I would say that yes, there's a concern, and also no, because there's a lot easier ways of like blowing up something than using a drone. There's the old saw about asymmetric warfare, that is never asymmetric for long because sides adapt, and if you develop a tactic, then a counter tactic will develop. So how long drones are really this sort of overarchingly useful weapon is one question. Whether or not any antagonists to the U.S. end up finding a niche to use drones against the U.S. is a totally different question. And I would say that it's probably fairly unlikely. I mean, it's easy. As I said, you can buy a drone on the internet for $300. And, you know, there's videos of people who have wired up a taser to it. You could wire up a handgun to a iPhone-controlled drone and fly it around. And, you know, you could do that with a radio-controlled propeller plane that you could get 20 years ago. You could figure out a way to arm that somehow if you wanted to. What that's going to get you is kind of the real question. What's the tactical advantage? Why would somebody do that other than to sort of have the thrill of the sort of headline grabbing thing that, oh, it was a drone attack?
So I've actually looked this up.
This is just a slight side note, but I believe California law forbids hunting animals with drones or robots or any sort of remote-controlled weapon platform. I think it goes back to like old like traps and, you know, tripwires and rigged shotguns or, you know, that sort of thing. But if you look at the letter of the law, you cannot, for instance, hunt wild boar with drones.
Yeah, there was a hunt by drone business that started in Texas, I want to say, but they got shut down because of a similar law that you cannot have remotely operated firearms for hunting purposes. But I mean, of course, like the law is the law, but then people break the law. I mean, so the law on drones, if you want to know, is that up to 1,000 feet. And you have the vehicle in line of sight, you can do whatever you want without a license, because that's the same as like a remote control helicopter, plane, whatever. But you know, who's out there? The FAA isn't out there monitoring to make sure that you have line of sight on your aircraft all the time. You know, to make sure you don't go a few feet above 1,000. Actual licensed drones above that height are coming in 2015, I think is the date. There's already applications in file. Check out the EFF, the Electronic Freedom Foundation, has tons of documents. They've been doing all the Freedom of Information requests to figure out who's applied for a permit. Actually, half of the permits for drones are from universities, researchers, people who want to start experimenting with the technology. So that's kind of, you know, people just kind of assume, I found that they assume that it's going to be police forces immediately buying all these up, but it's going to be the research institutes first that really explore what the technology can do for domestic uses, because the drones for you know, the military drones are designed for that specific task, and the mission profiles in domestic use and civilian use are going to be very different. So.
Okay. I hope by Ars Electronica, by next year, I hope we'll have a couple of drone porns around. Yes, really.
Because we were trying to find drone porn. We did not.
Well, GoPro porn.
There's Google Glass porn. Have not found drone porn yet. So fingers crossed. Keep searching Google. Set your Google alerts. We'll find it.
Come here. Like.
So I guess this is a challenge for the various brainy perverts and makers in the crowd. A drone whose sort of action and pathing and control is determined by someone's sexual biofeedback. So elevation, heading, direction, or it fucks another drone. Yeah. Teledrone Donix, I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bring him back.
There you go.
I want to see that. Big applause. Thank you very much.
Thank you.